So I just keep going. So I came back from Sotheby's with this dusty old looking collection of books and a few paintings and some quite fun cartoons. And I put them on the shelf at home with my other cookbooks. And I thought, God, have I just wasted a load of money? And I started looking through them, and what I discovered was that the idea of chefs being obsessive, passionate people, full of opinion, is nothing new. There was extraordinary, you know, outrageous, strong viewpoints that echoed throughout the ages. And, I mean, there was a guy called William Kitchener who wrote an amazing book called The Cook's Oracle in the early 1800s. And he slagged off every single cookbook that had come before him, saying that, you know...
In this book, he actually did that in his book.
Yeah, he says no other book previously has done decent measurements. All other books are nicked from everywhere else. They're all plagiarised. They don't work properly. The recipes don't work. This is the first book you'll ever come across where the recipes work. And I thought, God, this is so funny, because every PR who sends me the latest cookbook, the latest sensation, says exactly the same thing. And I thought, well, this is nothing new. And then I started going through other books, and I came across a dictionary of food by Cassels. They produced these big dictionaries of food in the 19th century. And there was a whole chapter about leftovers and what a brilliant innovation this was. And I thought, well, hang on a second. Here I am as a magazine editor saying exactly the same thing, again, almost 200 years later. So that's nothing new. And I started delving back into time and looking at far older books, and I came across a book from 1500, the first ever printed recipe book, in which it sort of said, and I'll paraphrase, no other book has ever been as good as this one. Here beginneth a tome of wonderful recipes. Anyway, the inference was the same.
And you had three other emails telling you the same thing that day,
yeah,
did you?
Exactly. So I thought, well, I'm onto something here. And you know, because I sort of, you know, live here and I work in London, and I come across a lot of foodies and the mad, bad foodie obsessives like Marco Pierre White, who, you know, when he's not throwing the contents of a cheese board against the wall, is cutting the aprons off people in his kitchens because they say it's too hot. And I thought, well, there must be these characters also in history. And you go right the way back to early ancient Greece and you come across characters. There was a man called Archestratus who recorded, you know, the lengths that he went to find the right ingredient. And so...
Was this for the cheesecake that you were talking about, the honey cheesecake?
Yeah. That was a guy called something else, some other long Roman name. I can't remember. I'll have to look in the book. He had a recipe for fish that you wrapped in fig leaves. And he said, you know, do not add anything else. Simplicity is the key. And I thought, well, that's another trend, isn't there? And this is from ancient Greece. So I basically thought, I want to write a history that brings together the great characters, the great food, the great ingredients, the innovative techniques across history. And we came up with this idea of a history of food and 100 recipes, so that I would deliberately pick 100 moments in food, 100 recipes, 100 references to food, and write an essay that told that story.
What I find quite interesting about the book, William, is that each chapter on its own sits on its own merit. You split them into 100 chapters, and they read sort of from beginning to sort of closure. But you do make references to other parts of the book in case people want to sort of discover more. I mean, I've read some of these chapters out loud to my children, and I haven't been able to put it down, to be frank. But you start off, there aren't recipes that you can follow in here. So there are some that you could perhaps try and have a go at, but that some, as they get sort of towards the end of the century, was that a problem to find recipes themselves?
Well, the first thing was that when we first did the first draft of the book, I produced for every single chapter a modern interpretation of a recipe that might have been quite old and therefore was uncookable. And I then decided that actually what we should be doing is not trying to interpret, not trying to translate, but to literally show people how recipes were written down. And if you want to have a go, have a go. I mean, it might be in future editions that we might translate them. But the other thing was that, for example, there wasn't a recipe for bread written down in the English language till about the early 1600s. Yet, bread was, of course, the mainstay of cooking for many, many centuries. So I had to go back and find the earliest reference, which was an image, part of the Bayeux tapestry. Mm-hmm. And that's my starting point for that. So,
and yet there were references also in the tombs to the pharaohs also making bread and milling their flour looking like they were gossiping and chatting.
Yeah, I mean, funny enough, even though in the early part of the book, I mean, for example, you know, the reference to dried fish from the Vikings is not a recipe, it's a reference. The first chapter in the book is a recipe because, remarkably, in a tomb from about 1900 BC near Luxor, up on the dusty slopes of this hill overlooking the plain of Luxor in Egypt, there is a tomb. It was built for a woman, which is very rare. And in that tomb is the very clear and beautiful painting which describes how Egyptian flatbreads were made. I mean, literally, I got someone to transcribe the hieroglyphics and the imagery, and it shows you how to cook it. I mean, it shows women, grinding, making flour, grinding the grain to make flour, mixing it, letting it sort of prove. And they made it next to where beer was being brewed, so they would have got yeast from there.
Natural yeast,
or just used it deliberately. I mean, who knows quite when people discovered that you could, if you added yeast to bread, it would make it turn into a fluffy thing. Anyway, and then it shows people cooking them and et cetera, et cetera. So it was quite a clear recipe. But then in the early, you know, when the Vikings were marauding over the north part of this country, when they came invading, they ate a lot. They ate a lot of dried fish. What they didn't do while they were knocking down your little wooden hut and before they raped you and set fire to you and your family, they didn't stop to write down recipes. They weren't that kind of people. So what I've done is I've found a reference to dried fish being bought from somewhere by a guy called Grettir the Strong, who was about to fight an Adler the Red. Anyway, there aren't any Viking recipes because they didn't write stuff down and they were pretty illiterate and they were pretty brutal. So in that chapter, I found a reference to fish. But as you say, as time goes on, we find more recipes being written down, first of all in manuscripts, and then in early printed books, and so on. So the book becomes more practical as we go along. So in a way, you have to be entertained just by the writing and your imagination, in a way, in the early part of the book.
So you've taken, I mean, to describe the book, I was trying to describe it to somebody. And I was talking about the fact that there were recipes sort of from ancient Rome and Greece all the way through to Nigella's cupcakes. And, of course, my children found it absolutely amazing as I was reading it to them that we suddenly stumbled across a chapter on chocolate to be reading about cannibalism. I mean, obviously, it's covering a huge range of subjects. That's a pretty wide range of, and places that the entire world.
Well, I had to choose where I stopped and where I focused on. And it was quite a tough choice, but there are some moments that really stand out. There's a telephone.
Now you see, we're going to have to answer the telephone now.
Hello?
Was it your mother?
No, it was someone. I've got a problem. There's too much moss on the back lawn. So we need to do some moss treatment and scarifying.
I normally find it's my mother in the middle of an interview. Yeah. She wants to know where I am and what time I'll be finished.
My mother doesn't ring, she just turns up. But anyway,
you'll have to retrain her. William, we were talking about the fact that it covers the whole of the world and picking out sort of which ones. Could you write another book?
Well, let me answer that previous question first before we come on to the next one. There are moments in food history that jump out as being very, very key and that you cannot but concentrate on them. And one of the most important moments in food history is the moment when the Spaniards, the conquistadors, discovered, conquered, you know, savagely beat up and then tried to teach Christianity to the natives of New Mexico, which they then called New Spain, or Old Mexico, but anyway. So when Cortes, the famous Spanish conquistador, travelled to what was then the old Aztec Empire, and came across Montezuma, the great Aztec leader, this was a very important moment for several things. Because basically the Spaniards discovered a lot of things. They discovered chocolate, they discovered chilies, they discovered turkeys, and they discovered, you know, all sorts of spices, and they brought these back. And, of course, they discovered gold, and which, of course, you can eat if you make gold leaf. So, and these things were real game-changing moments in food history. And chocolate, of course, became a great commodity. For many, many years, they kept the secrets of how you brewed it, you know, very, very, very tightly. And there is this wonderful moment when Cortes meets Montezuma. There are a few weird moments because before he basically conquered and then killed Montezuma, Montezuma entertained him. And they had these great feasts for all of Cortes's men. And bubbling away amongst the turkey and the corn and the kind of tortillas, tamales as they called them, which is a different kind of tortilla really, were these rather looking, strange looking bits of meat sticking out of pots, which of course were human arms, which rather alarmed the men. But one of the things they had towards the end of these meals was frothy chocolate. And it's a great moment in food history, the first mention of chocolate. And it was written by one of Cortes's men who was a historian who recorded in detail this trip. And he talks about how Montezuma enjoyed his hot chocolate all frothed up.
Along with the fact that he would actually have little sort of boys and girls plumped up and fattened up in order to sacrifice them and eat them. So he would have hot chocolate along with you know, a roast arm of somebody. So completely...
Yeah. Teenagers were reared for sacrifice. And it's, you know, it's horrific.
Well, inevitably in food history, you're going to come across some kind of cannibalism.
I don't know how they cooked arm of young boy. I mean, we laugh about it now, but imagine if you were a Spaniard arriving in this distant land, and amongst the gold and chocolate and spices, you saw caged children. I mean, unreal. Unreal.
Grim.
But you see, they, you know, so the Spaniards tried to civilize the Aztecs in saying, look, it's not cool to eat people. But meanwhile, the Aztecs showed that they had invented the wheel, which the Spaniards hadn't really come across.
And yet the Spanish came in with horses, which the Aztecs hadn't seen.
Well, which totally terrified the Aztecs because they saw these sort of two-headed monsters on four legs. And, of course, Montezuma had far more men than there were Spaniards, but the Spaniards had this sort of secret of surprise by being able to attack them with the men on horses. But
was Montezuma one of the first people who had food issues? Because I was reading to see perhaps that he wouldn't eat in front of other people. Is that right?
Oh, completely. I mean, he liked to eat alone.
Right.
So they would create a sort of tented area or screened off area in his banqueting hall, and he would have a little man dancing a jig in front of him, and then the women would bring him various foods, and he didn't like to being seen eat. So, and funnily enough, neither does the Queen, which is why she doesn't taste stuff when she's touring the country, because, you know, I suppose it gives people an opportunity for an unfortunate photo opportunity. So Montezuma also didn't like the equivalent of unfortunate photo opportunities by people seeing him, you know, trying to talk with his mouth full or stuffing his face with a young leg of young boy.
William, you chat about this. I think one of the things that your book has done is totally brought history to life. I mean, literally, it feels like a sort of... everything's so fresh the way you've written it, which is brilliant. And it's not dusty, it's not old, it's not boring. It's fascinating and interesting all the way through. You have so much material here. Could you write the next 100 recipes? Is that something that you... Or does that sort of... That's too much sort of like a... not again, thank you.
Well, no, I've got some ideas. I'm talking to my publisher about a couple of ideas. There's a few strands, a few ideas that have come out of the book. I don't know if I should talk about them. One really, there is one idea that I want to pursue, and that is there's an amazing story that has never been told about how Lord Woolton, who headed up the Ministry of Food, fed the British people during the tough days of rationing, because, and I write this in the book, it's one of the great untold stories of the Second World War. Lord Woolton was managing the food supply, and of course he was preaching a very firm message that you shouldn't use the black market, you should only rely on the ration, and generally speaking, people did adhere to that. But there were weeks when some of our ships coming over from America carrying flour, bacon, eggs were torpedoed by the Nazis, and Woolton didn't know how he was going to feed the British people by the end of that week. And if the British people weren't fed, morale would have been damaged. It was, you know, it was touch and go at times. But he had these kind of foodie agents that he sent out to the back streets of Cairo and Istanbul, doing dodgy backstreet black market deals and maintaining the ration as a result. And there's an amazing story that's never been told. So I'm quite interested to sniff around and see if there's something further to be written about that.
I did read, actually, that one in four of the ships there, you said, were sunk, which is, you know, that's a lot. But I was also fascinated a little while ago to find that Churchill commissioned civil oranges to come for the marmalade because he felt that marmalade would keep the sort of British morale up.
Well, and it does still, doesn't it? I mean, civil oranges. I mean, it's extraordinary. Here we are, come January, the amount of people who love to indulge in the tradition of making marmalade using an ingredient that is completely not English, Scottish, Welsh, Irish, you know, it's Spanish. And it's very, very seasonal. And if you make marmalade as well as my wife Laura does, it can keep you going for the entire year. She makes as much marmalade as we can, so that we've always got a pot on the go and we've got plenty of pots for friends. So that Churchill, as you say, made sure that the women of Britain didn't run out of civil oranges shows that he understood the mentality and the, you know, of the psyche of the British cook.
I'm going to come back to the fact that you're talking about British women. Whenever I've read histories of food, they've been quite crusty and not really that writable. I've got to be truthful, I've laughed out loud in a few places as I've been reading this. It's completely readable. It seems to me that you've written something that is very accessible for people. How is it that you've managed to do such a quite a heavy subject in such a way that it's both interesting, light, fascinating, and yet with all that depth to it, William, because I think it's wonderful.
Well, that's
sorry, funny. I'm complimenting. No, you're blushing fine. Now, aren't you? I'm speaking from the heart. Sorry, William, carry on.
It's not deliberate. I mean, to be honest, I've spent the last 20 years writing for the British middle market and basically writing for a female readership, and where editors and publishers and so on have always talked about the importance of accessibility. And so because I have a sort of tabloid instinct in me, and I've worked for British tabloids, I used to work on The Express, I've written for The Mail, I edit a magazine, a mainstream food magazine for the British middle classes, Waitrose Kitchen, and it has to be accessible. I mean, there's no point writing about stuff unless people can feel they read it. So it's not deliberate. It's deep within me that every sentence has to be readable. And also, I'm not an intellectual. I'm very much a consumer of middle market press and magazines, and I love, you know, homes magazines and food magazines and so on. So, like you, you know, I have to say I subscribe to The Spectator and I buy The Times. The way that I write, I think, is in a straightforward way, that in a way that I've been trained to write over the years. So for me, in a way, it was a challenge, because certainly the early chapters of the book, where you're looking at very dry material, where you really have to read between the lines as to who was doing what was being said and how it felt and so on, and what was Apicius's kitchen like? Mm-hmm. You know, here was ancient Rome's greatest cook, who wrote the first ever cookbook, and there's no description of his kitchen, but you have to come up with an idea of what it was like from reading the recipes. And so I've done things like that. So I've used my imagination to paint a picture of a man running a kitchen with artisanal produced tools, using, of course, a lot of free slave labor, because that was the great thing about those days, where labor,
I miss that.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I noticed throughout the book, is that until I don't know, 40 years ago, in fact, I'm going to blame Kenwood on this, that we actually don't have the domestic help in the kitchen anymore as women.
It is one of the big themes in the book, the so-called liberation of women, by giving them newfangled equipment, gas ovens, electric cookers, Kenwood mixers, fridge freezers. And when all these products came out, from whether they were a toaster or whether they were a Kenwood mixer, they were sold as being a tool to liberate women. And it didn't really work like that, because actually, women may have felt rather more liberated, certainly the sort of the middle classes in this country, when they had domestic help, when they had servants. Of course, after the war, everything changed, and this so-called liberation robbed them of their servants and gave them this new equipment. So the husband would come home at the end of the day saying, you know,
where's my
tea? Yeah, exactly. I've bought you this wonderful cooker. Or look at this delicious, wonderful fridge I've given you. Now, what have you cooked for me? And the poor woman would be thinking, oh, God, you know, is this really freedom? So, and so I think that in a way, these so-called liberating tools, in fact, rather enslaved women to the kitchen. And it wasn't really until, well, Elizabeth David really brought cooking to life for women, but certainly Nigella, when she actually discovered that baking could set a woman free, because it actually meant that you could enjoy, have a real visceral, you know, tactile approach to baking. And so there was a glimmer of freedom that she actually finally offered.
And yet Nigella really stirred up some serious people objecting. Certainly, there were articles in the Mail, and you write about it, that basically accused her of bringing the woman back to the sort of slave age by cooking a cake. Do you think Nigella really liberated us, or do you think she sets the bar so high that we're all struggling to get over it still?
I think that she was really attacked. I mean, she got the most savage press, and I was looking through all the old cuttings for the book, and I was amazed by the hatred that she inspired from various sort of so-called social commentators, people like Suzanne Moore in the Mail. But what she was writing about was the idea that actually baking could be great fun, and baking could free you from the humdrum every day, because she realised that, you know, she talks about having to, you know, work, cook, a little bit of play, work. And what she was trying to say is, look, if you're going to cook and you're going to bake, think about it from a way that actually you can enjoy it. And she also, she sort of says that she sort of invented a kind of fantasy childhood of hers, which didn't exist, where, you know, everyone was baking cakes and the children were happy and we were running around and were smiling. But, did she set people free? I don't know. Did she make cupcakes taste better? Did she make the making of cakes seem more enjoyable? I think so, certainly. And I think she was responsible for a birth in, you know, cupcake cafes and so on. So, and I think that you've seen all around the world really now, especially in America, especially in this country, the sort of cupcake cafe culture. And people there are, you know as well as much as anybody, you know, in the blogosphere, the interest there is in making cupcakes. And that stems from Nigella. So she made cooking food less of a chore. She sort of taught people to enjoy it.
Made it basically quite attractive and sexy. I've got to say that the acknowledgements in the book, at the end of the book, there's a little bit here, and it says, "To my darling wife Laura, who coped with me for so many months, with every weekend destroyed as I sat in my study thumbing out words to come up for air, stressed and hungry and a grump every now and again." Well, I burst out laughing at this, because that was a description of me with my book when I wrote it. You get all involved. It's all, you know, have you come up for air? Are you sort of finally recovering from writing it?
Oh, yeah, I've come up from air. But I do, I mean, I use the word thumping. I thump out words. I bang my keyboard very, very hard. It's a sort of, there's a flourish. I mean, I really feel the words. You know, I mean, it's physical. I mean, I have a full-time job. I had a food magazine, and so I had to write this book in the evenings, in my spare time. I had a task set of writing 5,000 words a week for 6 months, and that did mean every weekend was destroyed. It did mean that, you know, if we had to go out for lunch, I was just in a panic. If I didn't get to Sunday night, having finished a particular chapter, I would just be in a state of nerves. So it was very, very tough. It wasn't anything like as tough as some people, you know, the lives that many people have to have, but it is very physical. And writing a book is a physical thing, as well as an emotional, as well as a sort of intellectually taxing. But I have come up for air now, and I'm enjoying it. I mean, when this book arrived, the first one that came, I sat in my study in the place that I wrote it and sort of touched it lovingly, because it is very tactile. And I sat there sort of sobbing, having a little private moment.
I cried too.
But you do, don't you? I mean, it's... You know, I've written quite a lot for newspapers and magazines, et cetera, et cetera.
They turn into next week's fish and chip paper.
Yeah, exactly. But there's nothing like, you know, you have a book. I mean, I come from a family of writers, and I've got shelves upon shelves of books here at home. And my grandfather wrote over 130 books. But I put my little book up next to one of his, and I felt, right, there's one down, 129 to go.
William, thank you so much for chatting to me. There were two words that really said volumes to me in the book. And as a person who read it, and as a wife and a mother and what have you, those two little words just said it all for me. And they were the first words I read, and it said for Laura.
Well, that's right. I mean, it is for her. I owe her everything, really. You know, she makes our lives here at home, and she's a great mother, a wonderful wife. I'm incredibly lucky. I wouldn't have written this book without her. I wouldn't be where I am without her. So this book is for her.